Our last case this morning is 2022-0733, State of Ohio versus Adrian Jordan, and 2022-0734, State of Ohio versus Sasha Johnson. Mr. Beadleton. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, members of the Ohio Supreme Court. May it please the court, Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Counsel,
what proposition of law are we dealing with? Because what was in the jurisdictional memorandum isn't in the merit briefs.
Yeah, I believe it's a proposition of law of whether or not the Sixth Amendment allows specifically for counsel of choice by a defendant in a criminal matter, and then the application of that, because it also requires that they...
That's not what's written in the proposition of law in the jurisdictional memorandum, is it?
In the proposition of law in the jurisdictional memorandum is that the conflicts of interest in multiple representation cases should be judged by a clear and understandable standard or test.
And that's what we granted, correct?
Yes. And that is what we are asking for, Your Honor.
Doesn't the case law, like State v. Lloyd, say that, and List v. Johns Manville, we're only going to deal with propositions of law that we approved and brought in?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's not what the three propositions of law in your merit brief remotely deal with.
I believe they do, Your Honor, to the extent of what we are asking for is a factor test specifically to apply whether the
Sixth Amendment. Our appendices to the rules of practice have the exact same words on the jurisdictional memorandum as for propositions of law as in the briefs on the merit.
Yes, Your Honor. And I do believe they are the same proposition of law because what we're asking for is a factor test.
Well, you have three propositions in the merit briefs.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And you have one different than all the other three in the jurisdictional memorandum.
Yes, Your Honor. I only intend to address specifically the...
Why should we not improvidently allow this case?
I believe that, because this was... The court accepted jurisdiction on this matter under the first
proposition that's not mentioned in the merit brief.
I guess the wording is not specifically the exact same. However, it is the exact same proposition of law, Your Honor.
Tell me how.
Because what we are asking for is a understandable standard or test, specifically one that I believe, which is in the merit brief, creates the argument that first there should be a presumption that a defendant has a right to counsel of choice. Now, it still requires that it be effective, which is, again, what is addressed in the merit brief, but we are asking for a factor test, which is outlined in the merit brief, that specifically that the court should apply the specific facts of a case when they disqualify an attorney, which we do not have in this matter.
What do you mean we don't have in this manner? It's the specific facts are two people who were arrested and charged with the same offenses, and because one was a driver or one was an owner, or that there could be competing interests. I mean, the trial court did lay out the facts. So whether the trial court abuses discretion may be a question, but is that reviewable by us? And what standard could we set?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So simply outlining a statement of the facts of the case is not the same as applying those facts of the case. Inherently, we have an issue going forward where it is impossible. Dual representation is not per se...
It's not prohibited.
Visible.
Right.
So... Without the application of the facts in the case, the counsel, when accepting dual representation, cannot apply that to determine whether or not a conflict does exist or disqualification is proper. And then an alternative, the court, when they are not required to apply the facts of the case, subsequently, when we are dealing with erroneous disqualification, the court is left with no guidance as to what is erroneous disqualification.
So do you think, based on the facts of this case, that the trial court was premature in its decision? Do you think that there would have been the opportunity for counsel to withdraw from one or both representations?
Yes, and I think that the council has a duty to withdraw when the conflict does arise. And I believe that they are best suited in their position after meeting with their client, especially when properly executed waivers of conflict have been executed and presented to the court. Here, counsel was disqualified prior to a suppression hearing being held on this matter. Inherently, there is no conflict that exists in the suppression hearing because both parties have the exact same interest in the dispositive evidence being excluded from the trial court.
Well, what about the plea bargaining posture?
Well, so the plea bargain posture is not inherently a conflict. The prosecution has no obligation to present plea bargains, and
right, but wasn't there something manifest? Wasn't there something said that the ability to plea in this case takes place before suppression hearing? If the suppression hearing does not go in favor of the defendants, then that changes the position.
Their
exposure is greater.
Yes, and that is something that, well, that is a very specific policy that is unwritten, and it is certainly not a rule that applies specifically to this prosecution's office. It is not required. The prosecution never has to engage in plea bargaining.
Right.
In the same extent, they do not have to, they are not bound by any sort of obligation that
but wants. But clearly, their position, as is your client's, changes based on the ruling on the motion to suppress.
But that position, I don't believe, is based on any law. The conflict doesn't exist, and no plea bargains were ever entered into.
Why is that not a conflict? If one of the defendants is completely innocent and one is guilty, and they're represented by the same counsel, and the prosecutor, knowing they have risk at a suppression issue, offers them both a plea that's advantageous, why should the innocent person be forced to take that plea to avoid the risk?
Exposure.
Absolutely, because that is not the client's position. They were asked their position, and that is put forth with the entry of a not guilty plea, was that both are not guilty. There is not a position that either held that one is guilty and the other is not, and the dual representation had any sort of effect on that.
Well, the trial court doesn't know what's happening behind the scenes when one lawyer is representing two and what's being told to these people and whether it's correct or not. The only way to safeguard that is if they have their own attorney, right?
But the result in that would create a reality where dual representation would always create a conflict, and that is not what we have.
Not always. You could just have a hearing like this trial court judge did and explore it, and he felt that the conflict was obvious in this particular case.
But he did not apply the specific facts to the case, so we are still left with the reality where it is not clear what facts of this case made it to where disqualification was proper. If he had applied the facts of the case instead of simply a statement of the facts, that not only would have served our clients well, but also attorneys going forward when accepting cases, as well as judges down the line when looking at these similar hearings. What we have here is simply a statement of the facts with no application of those facts to the case.
So isn't that really the heart of your jurisdictional memorandum to this court?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
At page 10, you say that the trial court's determination was devoid of any factual findings from the proceedings, and it was overly conclusory. So what would the trial court have had before them in order to distill the facts?
Well, so they specifically, there were two hearings. There was, and both were conducted on the record.
Right. So what facts would they have had?
They had simply the allegations, but not necessarily, but then those allegations were never applied to why disqualification was proper.
So they had the allegations.
Yes.
They had what they were charged with in the indictment.
Correct. And basically a rough understanding of what the allegations were in the context surrounding them.
Is that in the record? Was that testified to? Is that a police report? What is that?
Yes, I believe that it was testified to by the prosecution in at least the first hearing, if not in both hearings, Your Honor. And those are the hearings that, again, were conducted on the record, neither of which were in camera. So
that those facts would have been argued or proffered by the state?
Yeah, well, I don't necessarily believe that they were argued. Certainly, the prosecution was arguing their motion because it was their motion to disqualify. However, the prosecution, the way it currently stands, bears no burden in showing any potential conflict or serious potential conflict or actual conflict. This is entirely on the court to make the determination. So what we have here, effectively, is there is no argument to the application of these facts. It is simply, here are the facts, but we are left with no understanding of...
So what additional facts could the trial court have said in the entry that would have passed your test?
Well, so it's not that there would necessarily be additional facts, but the facts that we had applied to the decision. It is because of these facts. So the fact that there are two women in a car, does that rise to the conflict? Is the fact because it is a drug trafficking case, does that create the potential seriousness, serious potential of a conflict? We don't know. We have what the facts are, or specifically what the facts are alleged to be. But we do not have the application of what specific facts are created a proper disqualification here.
So are you saying that the trial court was deficient in the entry explaining its decision then?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So is this a final order?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
It's a final order because when an attorney is disqualified, and this gets into the structural deficiency, when an attorney is left to is disqualified, what we have is then representation goes on with another attorney.
Right.
And if that attorney is ineffective, well, first you then have the violation of the Sixth Amendment, I believe. Then if that attorney is ineffective, you cannot compare what an attorney who was disqualified would have done. So this is simply the only remedy.
Right, so it's a structural error.
Yes.
And if it's a structural error, then on appeal following a final judgment, you would be entitled to automatic reversal.
Yes.
So I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that because of that, this is not immediately appealable. Why should, I mean, our rule says very clearly, 2505.02 says that the only time a provisional remedy can be immediately appealed is when it determines the action with respect to the provisional remedy, which I think this does, but also B, the appealing party would not be afforded a meaningful or effective remedy by an appeal following final judgment. Here, an appeal following final judgment, you can have an effective remedy. If counsel was disqualified wrongfully, you get a new trial. It's automatically. It's really no lose for you.
But the second requires a showing. And as has been stated, the parties...
Well, the second requires a showing?
Well, that they would...
It requires you to show that you would not be afforded a meaningful or effective remedy. That's the showing it requires. Why wouldn't you have an effective remedy following an appeal?
Well, certainly, because oftentimes a criminal defendant, as a result of these disqualifications, may result in plea bargaining. When somebody enters into a plea bargain, for example, they've waived that right. Also,
that's never the test for a final order, right? I mean, it's not that if you can't appeal now, you might enter a plea bargain. If that were the case, then you could appeal everything.
Yes.
That would be the same with a motion to suppress or anything else. So,
absolutely. But the parties would also enter into then a separate representation which could not be reversed because at that point...
Sure, it could be reversed. You could be ordered a new trial.
I believe that the standard would at that point be that also that the counsel provided an effective assistance.
If the law is clear that it's a structural error if you have to, if you're deprived of counsel of your choice wrongfully, so it's automatic reversal.
Yes, I believe it is counsel's belief that there would be no remedy that would be available at that juncture.
Why wouldn't a new trial be a remedy?
Well, a new trial would be a remedy, but I think that that would not serve any of the public policy. I don't think it would serve the court to adopt that, but simply that this cannot be addressed until after the entire process has come to a conclusion.
Wouldn't it be better for your client that way? Because that way your client gets two shots at the apple, right? I mean, that way your client could be acquitted the first time with different counsel, or if he was she was wrongfully deprived of counsel of her choice, she would get a new trial. So it would be better for defendants.
Yes, but it may be better for my client. It is not better for the court or the U.S. Constitution's right to effective counsel.
I don't think that's true. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear that it doesn't violate U.S. Constitution. In fact, as the U.S. Supreme Court has pointed out, that actually defendants do better because they get two bites of the apple there.
And I understand that position, Your Honor. It is simply not a position we are taking. I see that my time is expiring, and unless there are further questions, I would ask that the court just deny the disqualification order and remand this back to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Willis.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. My name is Jay Willis. I'm here on behalf of the Scioto County Prosecutor's Office representing the state of Ohio. I'd like to start out where Justice Fisher started us off. We asked in our brief, Your Honors, to find that this was improvidently accepted and to not take the handle of this case. And we went ahead in our brief and replied to the propositions of law that were presented there.
But aren't they aren't verbatim, but isn't the essence still the same as the proposition of law that this court accepted?
Thank you, Your Honor. I can't argue that. I would agree that, yeah, it's a very... The proposition that was in the jurisdictional memorandum was very broad, it was very general. So yes, I think it could come under that. And that's why we went ahead and responded to all three of their propositions.
So let me ask this question. If the trial court judge, and first the state, and then the trial court judge properly brought up the issue of problematic dual representation, the court seemed very thorough, held hearings,
yes,
and then came to a decision about the representation, why couldn't after repeated assurances that this is what the clients wanted, the possibility of the conflict, they weren't allowed to constitutionally keep the counsel that they wanted? Obviously, if they lose and go on appeal, they can't say we were prejudiced by dual representation.
Sure. I think, as you stated, the trial court held the first hearing, went into great detail with both defendants, but did not explore, and neither side brought up any of the facts of the case at that point. And I can't speak for the trial court judge, but I'm fairly certain he wasn't comfortable making his decision until he had some facts in front of him. So that's why he scheduled that second hearing. At the second hearing, the parties presented on behalf of the defendant, they could have offered whatever facts that they wanted to. I don't believe they offered any. The prosecution brought up what they believe the facts of the case were, which you mentioned. We had a passenger and a driver. We had a console in the center where a large amount of cocaine was found. We had marijuana found in the passenger's purse. We had marijuana residue found in the door panel. The trial court then went through, talked to the defendants again, but he also went through and listed these facts as you stated. And in the trial court's decision, he went through and he found there was a serious potential that one defendant would change their position and claim the other committed the offenses alone. The trial court judge specifically raised the concern that you raised as far as the plea bargaining posture, because the assistant prosecutor at that hearing stated the state's position at that hearing was, if we go forward in this and have a motion to suppress and have to have that hearing, there will be no offers. Anything will be off the table. Now, I can't speak to any offers that were made at that point. I don't know that there were. But that's why I think this judge made the correct decision. And all of the things that he did apply a lot of the facts here.
Is that a general policy that your office employs?
No, absolutely not.
Is that it was just a single prosecutor in this particular case?
I wouldn't even say it was a single prosecutor. I would say it was limited to this case. This was a traffic stop. It was a drug trafficking. It was almost 170 grams of cocaine.
Right.
And the assistant prosecutor that was assigned to this case made that determination that she's the one that raised this issue on the conflicts.
But there's three possible outcomes. Like, they could both be guilty, they could both be innocent, or one might be guilty and one might be innocent, right?
True.
Okay,
true.
So, you know, why would you say if you lose the you have to go to trial if you lose the suppression issue.
Well, quite frankly, Your Honor, I think one of the things that we run into on these drug trafficking prosecutions a lot of time is delay, number one. And I'm not saying that this case was delayed, but the stop was made in June of 2020. We're here almost 3 years later, number one. Number two, the state has limited resources. I know we have more resources than the defense has, but one of those resources is taking the time to bring in our officers, prepare for a suppression hearing, go through the suppression hearing, and then our cards are on the table, so to speak, because then we present our evidence and the defense, you know, like Justice DeWine was pointing out, why wouldn't they take advantage of it and get multiple bites at the apple? And I think that's what we have here is an attempt to try to do that. But that's why I think in this case that decision was made and that assistant prosecutor stated, well, if we go into a suppression, we're not going to make any offers. And I don't know that any offers had been made to that point anyway.
Counsel, do you believe that the trial court fully understood or that the trial court believed the defendants understood the risk that were involved in representation, that defense counsel clearly articulated those, and at the end of the day, if that happens, would it be an abuse of discretion for the trial court to do what it did here, to say no dual representation, both of you have to get other lawyers?
Do I believe the trial court understood and explained it to the defendants? Well, yes, I do, in detail.
Okay. So, and if they so decide to continue going forward, is it an abuse of the trial court's discretion to then prohibit them from retaining that dual representation with current counsel?
You mean if he refused to accept the waivers?
Right. If the trial court refused to accept the waivers, as believing that maybe they didn't thoroughly understand, or maybe that the trial court knew better for them than they knew for themselves.
I don't think in this instance that it was an abuse of discretion based on the in-depth discussion that the trial court had at two different hearings and detailed quite thoroughly in his entry.
Do you believe that a trial court could have gone either way in that decision, or you believe it was...
I think based on the facts that he was presented with and based on the discussions, and you'll see when you review the transcripts of those two hearings, I think he was fairly certain in his decision, and I think he made the right decision.
So, Mr. Willis,
yes.
Your opposing colleague said that the trial court erred by not putting factual determinations, whether they were the client's position in the case, the relationship with their lawyer, the availability of alternate lawyers, or the nature of the conflict or possible conflict, and what other factors that would arise in these very fact-intensive situations. But, you know, what you're saying is that you have the judgment entry and you have a robust transcript. Is that enough?
Well, I think the judge did make sufficient findings based on what he had. He also had, keep in mind in the record, he also had the motion to suppress, which had been filed. So he knew what the allegations were going to be as far as more of the details of the stop. Now, whether he reviewed that or not, I can't speak to that. I'm not the trial court judge, but he did have that in the record.
So what I'm getting to is, should we be requiring, as your opponent requests, that all this be stated in an entry? Is that form over substance? And should we even be creating some kind of a test, knowing how many factual nuances can arise in situations involving a judgment on conflict and representation?
That's part of what we argued in our brief. I don't think so. I don't think there's a reason to, because I think the federal case law and what this court has already decided in the past gives the trial court enough guidance to do that. And I think this trial court did its job. I think the trial court made the proper findings based on and applied the proper precedents. I think the Fourth District Court of Appeals reviewed it and agreed with what the trial court did in its entry. And I think that was sufficient, because the trial court, as I was speaking to earlier, the trial court spoke to at least four or five different concerns that it had and said that these are serious potentials for conflict here based on the facts that the trial court was aware of. So I don't think there's any reason for this court to go and make some expansive ruling or set some kind of guidelines, because I think it's already there.
What if it was simply just to affirm that the trial court judge did the proper thing here, had a hearing, rather than not have a hearing and make a significant decision like that without exploring in detail?
Well, I think that's what we're asking for. We're asking this court to affirm the trial court's decision and state that the trial court did what was necessary here. He had that second hearing because he was interested in trying to find out what the facts were, and he wanted to apply the facts. Now, granted, his version of the facts was limited, but it was limited necessarily at this point in the litigation during motion practice to what was before him. And again, I don't know if he looked at the motion to suppress. He might have. Knowing Judge Kuhn, he probably did, but he didn't make any of those findings in his entry, but I don't know that that was necessary. I think the Wheat decision is fully complied with here. We argued that in our brief. I don't think Gonzalez-Lopez expanded. I don't think it limited Wheat in any way. I think the Wheat decision is still good law. I think this court has applied Wheat. I think the federal courts have found that this court's application of Wheat is proper before Gonzalez-Lopez and after Gonzalez-Lopez. So that's why Our major point here, Your Honors, is if they ain't broke, don't fix it. This scheme to determine whether or not there's a serious conflict of interest in these types of cases is already solid and it's in place. There's really no reason to go through and make some kind of expansive ruling beyond.
Is this immediately appealable? Should this be allowed to be appealed right now?
You mentioned that earlier on the final appealable order. I didn't bring the case site, Your Honor. I think there's a case that's already determined that. I think it was
We did have a case that said that it was.
I thought it was.
But that case seems to be completely inconsistent with what the statute actually says. I wonder if that's something that you think we ought to revisit.
Perhaps. I didn't look into that. At this stage, I think it is a little bit problematic. We're 3 years down the road, and we haven't had a trial yet, and we haven't had a motion.
And you could go back. We could rule in the state's favor. Then trial could progress for a month, or not a month. Trial could progress for a few days, and maybe there might be something else that happened that showed that there was an issue between the. Between the two defendants, and there might be a request to withdraw counsel, and that would be immediately appealable.
And that was our concern.
We never finished the thing.
That was our concern when this was raised. Was we saw that these conflicts were possible here, and I think that's why Judge Kuhn did this. He saw that these conflicts were possible, and he said there's a serious possible conflict here. All of these things can change depending on what evidence comes out. If the suppression hearing goes forward, what evidence is going to come out? Are they going to come? Are the positions of the defendants going to come apart then?
How do you weigh that and balance that with the defendant's decision to maintain their current representation?
Well, I think
their constitutional right.
I think the nature of this on the trial court's part is it's going to be speculation regardless. I think he just has to make the best informed decision that he can based on the facts that he has in front of him. I think that's what he did.
What, and maybe you've articulated this already, but please again, for me, what would have been a potential bad outcome if the trial court said, well, I've conducted a hearing, I've explained to you the risks, your lawyers have explained to you the risks, but if you want to maintain your counsel, you have the absolutely right to do that, be it expense-wise or starting over and hiring new lawyers, whatever. We've thoroughly outlined, the state has called to your attention, I've called to your attention, and they decide to go forward.
Well,
what would have been the harm?
A bad outcome on behalf of the defendants.
Or just in general?
Specifically, I would say to the defendants, they're limiting their right to plea bargain, which we've already discussed. Mm-hmm. They go forward and have the motion to suppress and have that hearing. If they lose on that, then they're going forward, and their interests may or may not be aligned at that point. We have this is a potential constructive possession case.
And if that's the risk they're willing to take, because maybe behind closed doors, counsel says you have a better chance if you stay together or your positions, et cetera. If they understand that, why can't they assume the risk?
There's nothing to say they can't.
Well, they can't here because the trial court said, no, you can't.
Sure. But But down the road, I don't know what kind of evidence that the defense might have. The trial court judge didn't know what kind of evidence the defense might have. They might decide at some point down the road that their interests do diverge, and one of them does want to testify against the other and say, I didn't know about this stuff in the console.
So then
So
at that point, you're right. They have to get new counsel.
Exactly.
And so, but you said that's detrimental to the state position.
I think it's detrimental to the entire system at that point.
Okay. So. Thank you.
If there are any further questions, we would just ask that you affirm the Fourth District's decision and affirm the trial court's decision and do what's right in this case, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
All right.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a copy of the decision in the mail.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.